Hello, my name's Tamsin Westhorpe and welcome to Fresh from the Pod Gardening Stories. Now it's May and we're right in the heart of Candide's Festival of Flowers, which is a really exciting online floral event which celebrates everything gardening. So I wanted to talk to someone in this episode whose whole life revolves around growing flowers. So who better than Georgie Newbury of Common Farm Flowers. Now Georgie grows cut flowers organically in Somerset on her 7 acres and creates the most dreamy bouquets in a very ethical way. So I'm going to find out from her career path, I'm going to find out from her some top tips that we can all share, and I'm going to ask her which is her favourite and most valued cut flower. Right, Georgie, this is brilliant. You and I, gardeners, appear on Zoom with the biggest headphones, both of us.
Hilarious. These ones belong to my 14-year-old son and they're very, very cheap and light and sort of manky. And this horrible, microphone, it's all been, they've been sat on, they've been screwed up, it's bent. But anyway, I hope they
will. Yeah, we look like we're just about to take off in a plane.
But everybody else I've interviewed has had these sort of little funky apple pods, you know. So this is great. I feel very comfortable. Now, I want to start because what I can't believe, there are you in your body warmer, probably dungarees and wellies,
yep,
in a shed. And your former career, you were a fashionista.
I know.
Who knew?
I know. Well, you know, I have very, very short attention span. And so I have had a career which anybody would, I think the word is a portfolio. So I tend to do something for a little while and then I get fed up with it and go and do something else. And but I haven't got fed up with flower farming yet. And we're 11 years in. So it must be keeping me interested somehow.
That's excellent. So, I mean, you worked. Explain to me what your fashion world was like, just so people can see the total contrast to now.
Well, when I was, I was about 24 and John Major was Prime Minister and there was a terrible recession, which some very elderly people like me might remember. And so there were no jobs. The business I was working for went bust. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? And my friend Alex said, let's go to Paris and get a job.
Like you do. Like,
as you do. So we packed the car with our duvets and bits and pieces. And we went to Paris and we managed to find somewhere to stay. I mean, really. And we signed up with a bilingual job agency. And she quite quickly got a job in a bank. And I got a job for a photocopying company.
Right.
And I was so bad at it. And my French was so terrible that they fired me the day before the end of my trial period. Not surprisingly, really. And so I rang up my other friend who was also living in Paris. It was weirdly, there were lots of us in Paris. And I rang up, I said, I've been fired. And she went, oh, there's a job here. And she worked at Vogue, American Vogue, on the Boulevard Saint-Germain.
I shouldn't laugh. I just can't see it. Anyway, carry on.
So I said, oh, of course I want a job at Vogue. So I then put on my best outfit, which at the time I had like an interview outfit, which was left over from when I left college. And it was a good calf length grey tweed skirt, pleated.
Lovely.
And a cream silk shirt, high necked. And I think I probably had black patent leather ballet shoes with bows on. Anyway, I went to see the lady who became my boss, who was this extraordinary woman called Miss Train, who is sadly no longer with us, but was an extraordinary, really extraordinary woman. And one of those people, if you come across this person in your life, grab them and make them so much more than your mentor. She became my friend, a sort of adopted godmother. She was amazing. So somehow I managed to persuade her to give me a job as her assistant. And I didn't speak terribly good French. And I looked like a country bumpkin because I am a country bumpkin. That's, you know, be who you are at all times.
Yeah.
And I then spent 5 years working in fashion in Paris. Not all for her, for most of the time. And then I spent a year with John Galliano. by which time that was kind of extreme chic, extreme fashion. And by then I had very short hair and I was very thin. I wore very, and we got all our clothes from sample sales. So we could afford them because we weren't paid anything much. We lived on Coca-Cola and chocolate from the office cupboard and cigarettes. Obviously we smoked vast amounts of cigarettes. And we could have free taxis because we could put them on expenses and bottles of Evian. We lived always a bottle of Evian in the hand. And we got into all the parties for free and stuff. So it was fun. But, you know, eventually, like a homing pigeon, I finally worked my way back.
And now I see you on Instagram in your pyjamas, followed by your Border Terrier tea cake, picking flowers. I mean, how cool is that?
And they're very nice pyjamas. I have to say, they're extremely stylish.
They are. We've seen them a lot during lockdown, I feel.
Now, I mean, you are at the fore, or you were, and you'll continue to be at the forefront of encouraging us all to buy British grown flowers. So that's your business now. And you're in Somerset and you're making it work, aren't you? I mean, what started that off?
Well, I, like a lot of people, I definitely had a fantasy about what my country life as a grown-up was going to be. Having been a child in the country, I had no real idea of what my parents did in order to make it into this sort of fantastic, beautiful, garden-y life that I grew up with. But, you know, I really did grow up doing miniature gardens for the village show type stuff and rushing home from ballet to watch The Secret Garden. I mean, it was really a very Ladybird book childhood, yeah. I'd say. And so when we I met my husband and we decided we both had this dream of a small holding. And so we found this extremely falling down farmhouse with 7 acres, which were a bog, really, a marsh. It was the worst land in the village, which is why it's called Common Farm, because it was the common land. And it really was very boggy. Now it's rather dry. It's quite different. And we thought we'd be smallholders. And like a lot of people, we had the John Seymour books about, you know, how to live off the land and be happy at your work. Anyway, I very quickly decided that cabbages were not for me because they take a really, really long time and a lot of room. And that you can't really sell them because you can buy them much more cheaply in the supermarket. And I decided that pigs were very hard work and also really nice and endearing. And so we found sending them off to slaughter very stressful. And then you'd have to have a vast freezer full of sausages, which would take you about 3 years to eat. And you really had to eat sausages at every meal in order to get through them. So anyway, that sort of market garden thing shrank as an idea, but at the same sort of time a neighbor sent me a bunch of flowers in the post one day and I had a complete light bulb moment. By then I had two really tiny children. They were 3 and 6 months old, and this bunch of flowers appeared, and they were lovely. They were a very nice bunch of flowers, but it did occur to me that I could do similar. I was like, yeah. or better. Well, not, I mean, I wouldn't want to say better, but, you know, I could definitely, this was something I could do. And it was a huge light bulb. I was like, that's it. I'm going to grow bouquets. I'm not going to grow. It never occurred to me to do wholesale. It never occurred to me. It was very, very straightforward. I was like, I'm going to grow bouquets and I'm going to send them by courier because I don't have to leave the house. So I don't have to pay childcare. And I can do it in between wiping runny noses and putting people down for a nap and all of that stuff that you do for a long time. And then I watched a program on the telly box with Monty Don, and it was called My Green Farm. And there were these very nice girls who are now good colleagues called, and I can't remember their names, but their business was called Blooming Green. And they had just started, and I think they had like a quarter of an acre, and they were just going to plough it up and sow some flowers. And at the end of the program, Monty Don said to them, well, this is very good. All you need to do, and he gave them a list of 10 things they needed to do. And I had done 9 of them.
good.
Anyway, just because I was gardening. And I thought, oh, well, then all I need to do is get a business card made. So I got a business card made. And I had no plan. I had no business plan. I now really teach lifestyle business, how to run a lifestyle business, because people have no idea. They have a sort of, oh, it's lovely. I'm going to do a lovely thing. I'm going to have a lovely time. And people are going to buy my lovely products that I'm going to have a lovely time making. And that is true with a little bit of strategic planning. Of course, I had no strategic planning. And so I've been learning on the hoof for the last 11 years. So I'm really, really good at teaching this workshop because I really know what I'm talking about.
I mean, what I love is the fact that you do teach that workshop. I mean, I've met numerous people that have been on your workshops, have started growing their own. To share that knowledge and not feel threatened, you know, because there is a big enough pool out there, isn't there?
You know, we spend 2.2 billion, probably a great deal more than that now. This is quite old research. We spend 2.2 billion on cut flowers in this country.
That's just Elton John, isn't it?
That is actually, that's my next, my neighbour down the road does. And now the British grown market has grown exponentially because everybody is much more conscious of the ecological impact of flying flowers in. You know, the big multinationals will fly flowers in from Venezuela in passenger planes, and they use the seats to fill up with boxes of flowers, and the cargo bit is full of boxes of flowers, and then they fly the plane back empty. And, you know, it's just not sustainable. And yes, and often those flowers are very, very cheap, which also tells you how little the people growing the flowers are being paid. And I mean, there's a whole thing. There's a great book, if any of your listeners are interested, called Gilding the Lily.
Right.
And it's the story of the international cut flower trade. And I really recommend that people, if they're interested, have a look. It's a very readable book. And the woman who wrote it, whose name escapes me, doesn't take a side at all. She's just very matter of fact. This is what happens. And at the end of it, if I challenge you to buy flowers that are imported, you've read this book.
Do you think the lockdown has helped with this? I mean, I think people have spent much more time in their gardens, which is well documented, but they're looking at the flowers. They want to see a natural look, which is what you're growing. And I don't know, we're obsessed with how long a bunch of flowers lasts. Which I had two bunches the other day. One was commercial, one was picked from the garden. Okay, the one lasted longer than the other, but I got far more pleasure out of the natural one.
Absolutely. And I think if as a grower or a florist that only uses British grown flowers, I think if we take a second to educate the customer that these flowers are not going to be in your vase in your dining room in 3 weeks' time. And frankly, why would you want them still there in 3 weeks' time? They'll be dusty. But they won't be there in 3 weeks' time. And the reason they won't be there in 3 weeks' time is you need to change the water quite often. I would say, ideally, every day I would change the water. Obviously, people don't always do that. But even two or three times over a 5 or 6 day period will really help. Ideally, you'll give them a clean vase. So I always tell people to have two identical vases. Vases, as a rule, are not enormously expensive. You can buy them at the supermarket. So have two identical vases, and one of them is kept clean, ready, and you take the bouquet out of the dirty vase, snip the bottoms of the stems off them, and put them into clean water in the clean vase, and the dirty vase just goes in the dishwasher for the next day.
Genius.
And that way you just permanently have, your flowers will grow and grow. And I had a lovely girl here the other day taking photographs for a magazine, and I gave her a posy to take home, and she posted a picture of it 6 days later. And she had properly looked after it. And the lovely thing was it had grown. The flowers were completely different. It was a totally different posy because she had dead-headed the odd bit that had gone, but the others had grown and expanded, and it had become a real kind of Dutch 17th century welcome art.
And I think we're used to this sort of static thing that we buy. And actually, like you're saying, you need to maybe take the flowers out, you know, edit them, pop them back in, downsize it. And I mean, what I really wanted to ask you actually is about plant feed. You're talking about cleaning the vase, flower feed rather. Do you use any?
No. And the thing is, well, I hate flower feed. Okay, think about it. Flower feed, obviously, if you buy it, comes in a little sachet, and it will not say the ingredients on it because it's not food grade for people. So there's no need to say what the ingredients are. But the chances are they are something like Milton sterilizing powder, mm-hmm. so bleach, something to like vitamin C powder to balance the pH, and sugar to feed the flowers. That's all. Now, if you think about it, you've got a nice vase on your table and you put bleach and vitamin C powder and sugar in it. One, I wouldn't want to knock that vase over because I might have quite a nice table and I'm going to get bleach sloshed all over my nice table. So that'd be a shame. Number two, if you put sugar in a vase with what is essentially already a bunch of compost, then the sugar and the bacteria which come from the bunch of compost, which is the stems of the flowers, are going to make more bacteria. The bacteria are going to be really happy, aren't they? So they're going to make the flowers go over more quickly. So the commercial flower grower will also have treated, probably not all of them, and actually in this country, increasingly few. But if they have traveled a long distance and need to last a long time, say, for example, roses from, and obviously there are good growers everywhere. I have to caveat this.
Yeah.
But a lot of them will have been treated by each time they are owned. And flowers go in and out of ownership about possibly three times before they end up on your kitchen table. Each time they are owned, they're possibly treated with silver nitrate, which stops them going over too quickly. So if you put flower food in your vase, you're trying to, including sugar, you're trying to feed a flower which has been treated to stop it coming out and to stop it producing ethylene, which is the same gas that bananas and tomatoes and so on produce. And where's the gas? What's the gas? The gas, perhaps, that's maybe where some of the scent comes because it's actually giving off. So let's not do all of that to our flowers. Let's just give them clean water and a clean vase and snip the stems, you know, half a centimeter off the stems every day, and your flowers will last a long time and you'll really enjoy them. And I know this, you know, my flowers, I had a girl email me last year, her father had dementia, and so she wanted to send some flowers to her mother for her birthday from her father. So it was a very big deal, you know, you've got to get these things right.
Yeah.
And it was a big bouquet. So I sent a big bouquet to this lady. And I had a note from the daughter who had popped in to kind of chat every day. And she said the flowers lasted 3 weeks and they had given her mother a pleasure, her mother, you know, not getting in the garden as much as she used to do and all of that stuff. Her mother had looked after the bouquet as if she was looking after a garden. And they had given her so much pleasure that they had vastly exceeded the price or the number of stems. Mm. And that's the point for me. That's what I'm doing. And I had another girl who regularly gets flowers from me. And she said, this was before lockdown. She said one day, I went to visit my mother and found that her garden is full of rooted cuttings from your bouquets.
Excellent.
It's brilliant. So she's taken all my shrubs and just rooted, she's got rosemary and she had some physocarpus and she had some brachyclops. She was just taking cuttings and said, and you could hang them upside down and they would set seed and you could use the seed. I mean, that, and I think that's a good thing.
It's the gift that keeps on giving, you're selling, obviously. But I mean, what I'm intrigued about is pricing, because if you're selling a lovely fistful of sweet peas, some people would expect to pay a few pounds. Others would pay. I sometimes think if it's too cheap, they don't believe it and they don't buy it. It's a bit like a painting. Where do you get that? How do you price it? It must be a minefield.
Now you need to come on the lifestyle business workshop, and I will take you through how to work this out. But no two people are going to sell their sweet peas for the same amount, because we don't work for the Milk Marketing Board in 1953, and they don't say we have to sell anything at X price. So we can set our own prices. But if you have worked out how much money you need to take in a season in order to keep yourself and your business afloat,
yeah,
and you are growing sweet peas and you intend to sell them in bunches of 10 or 20 or whatever, then think, how long does it take me to make a bunch of 10 sweet peas that I will sell for X? So what I tell people is not to sell ever a bunch of 10 sweet peas, because if you have, you know, I used to sell sweet peas in a barrow outside my front gate, and I may well do it again one day. And I did really jolly nicely out of it. I used a couple of hundred quid a week out of my barrow, which was very nice. But I was selling bunches of 10. I will never sell a bunch of 10 sweet peas. I'll sell a bunch of 20 or 30 or even 50. Ooh. And people go, oh, imagine 50 sweet peas. Imagine.
Gorgeous. Yeah.
Imagine. Mm. And that's, I don't know, 30 quid, 25, 30 quid. I'm not going to sell it for less. And I'm not going to have hundreds of tiny bunches that you can give me £1 or £2 for.
Yeah.
Because I then have to bank all those pounds. It's boring. There isn't a bank for 50 mile radius. It's a schlep. I'm not going to do that. I will sell more of them for more. And yep, not give people. The customer the choice. Because
yeah.
otherwise I have no skin on my hands at the end of the season. Otherwise, every bunch of sweet peas takes the same amount of time to do, whether you're doing 10 or 50, really. I mean, it's the time-consuming bit is the string. So, yeah. but, so just sell lots.
But when it comes to the sort of physicality of what you do, I know you're an early bird, aren't you? So is it very much you every day out there with your lovely trolley? I just adore that. I watched this brilliant video on YouTube of you planting sweet peas the other night. I was in absolute hysterics. I tell you, it's like the Farce Show. You've got your trolley, you've got your wheelbarrow, and then you go, oh, let's start again. We didn't put the sound on. But the advice is second to none, everybody.
Absolutely loved it.
I've stopped doing it. YouTube is tiring, and you have to hold your phone if you're going to film yourself, you've got to put your phone in a direction that you don't use for any other social media. And so in the last few months, I've been playing around with TikTok.
Oh, my word.
This is fun. I cannot tell you guys, this is fun. This is really, really fun. And because I'm a sort of boring, middle-aged, really no beauty, you know, I'm just a very straightforward woman. All the young people on TikTok really think that I'm absolutely hilarious. And they...
Well, you are.
No, but they're, but they're like, you're like Professor Sprout in the Harry Potter movies. And they're hashtagging it Herbology, which is apparently the gardening lesson in Harry Potter. I had no idea. Anyway, isn't that fab?
That's brilliant.
I'm having fun on TikTok.
I love that. You'll bring younger people in, which is absolutely the thing. Right. So you're out there, you're picking. Do you pick in the morning early because that's the right time to do it? Or is it just that your day is long because you've got so much to fit in?
It's probably in the morning early because it's a good time to do it. But also, I mean, after we've finished this conversation, I will do the manifest for the bouquets going out on tomorrow and Thursday. And I will do a stem count. And my children are older, so they don't come back from school till later. So this evening, I will start cutting for tomorrow. Because back in the day, I would have to do, you know, kids' tea and homework and all of that stuff. But they can now do their homework mostly on their own. And they've got after school clubs and all of that stuff. And we all have supper together at sort of 8 o'clock. So I've got much more time. So I tend to get more done in the evening, but I will still start early in the morning because I don't know about you. I think this is a sort of thing. It's my character. I'm always trying to be finished. I just want to be finished.
Oh, and you never are.
And I'm never finished.
Forget it.
So instead of thinking I'm never going to be finished and getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning, I always get up at six because then I might be finished. I'm never.
But you know,
finished. I bet if you're anything like me, if you were finished, I think, right, I'm going to go through all these emails, get them answered. And then if they ever stopped, I'd probably think, what's going on? What do I, what, what's happening? So, no, I think you're just a busy, busy person, a doer. So, right, what fascinates me is how you produce flowers for every month of the year.
Oh, that is purely a question of planning, madam.
Yeah.
And what you do, it's a bit like gardening, but different. I curate my bouquets, if you like. I start thinking about what's going to be in my bouquets when I plant them.
Okay.
So that can be 18 months ahead, if you see what I mean. I'm always pleased to see I've got a garden full of flowers, but I don't really worry about what I've got now. I'm always worried about what I've got in a month or 6 weeks or 3 months or next year. And that is all the time I slightly about making sure that I've got the future covered.
Yeah.
And because I know I plan my bouquets very carefully, and so I know the balance of showstopper flowers and foliage and filler. And I ballpark know how many bouquets a week I'm going to produce. And I know how many stems go into each bouquet. I can then work back from that in order to plan how much I'm going to plant.
Okay.
To the extent that I sow seeds 5 times a year. For example.
Right.
And so long as I know that I'm going to sow those seeds and I know that I've got those dates in the diary so that I don't miss them, and I know when I'm going to plant them out, but, you know, obviously weather.
Yeah.
Don't always mention it.
Yeah.
Let's not mention the frost. Anyway, so I slightly have to hedge my bets a bit, but, you know, it is amazing when a plan comes together, and year after year after year, my plan is refined so that I'm never growing a waste, because so, you know, one has a limited amount of space, but also a limited number of hours. And because I've worked out how much money I need to take and therefore how many bouquets. So it's more than that. I work out what profit I need to live on. And I work back from that. So profit to live on. So 3 times the value of that profit, ballpark, is the turnover. Divide the turnover into bouquets and or workshops and or weddings and or, you know, whatever I am splitting over. It then tells me how much I need to sell, how often. I then look at the number of hours in a week. How many, you know, there are 52 weeks in a year. I've got to split that money up. And suddenly you see that actually I'm growing X number of bouquets a week, X number of weddings a week. X number of workshops a week, and making sure that I get some time off.
Yeah, you see, the thing is, it's really interesting. You said earlier that people want to do this because they want to have this dreamy, rose-tinted lifestyle. But ultimately, it's got to work on paper. You've got to be able to eat.
And actually, I would argue, go to the pub from time to time for your mental health.
Buy new pyjamas.
Buy new pyjamas. Yeah. Go to Wales for a week's holiday. Because you and I both know, if you take a break and you stay at home, you don't stop.
No.
So you have to go somewhere. And that's, you know, not a cheap trip for a family of four and a dog.
So if you're growing non-commercial, you're just growing at home. I grow cut flowers in our vegetable patch, and I'm quite traditional. So I grow, like you do, in a row of sweet peas. I've got a row of really outrageous gladioli that I just love.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're popular still, but
they're regaining popularity like mad, because they're so good with the dahlias. So the dahlias have become very popular, and on the back of the dahlias, the glads are coming back, I think.
So if someone at home has a small patch or raised bed or whatever, do they, like with growing vegetables, do you do crop rotation or not?
I do.
I don't know whether you really have to. And I think I read somewhere recently, and I haven't researched it further, and I've no doubt you know more, so you can explain. But apparently, the old adage that leguminous plants set nitrogen is being debunked, which is terrible my sweet peas have been driving the rotation in my garden for years. So I haven't taken that any further, but I keep seeing it popping up as a thing.
I haven't either. That's interesting. I have to look into that.
So I wonder if I've been wasting my time. But anyway, I use my sweet peas to drive a rotation. And it doesn't matter whether you're doing, you know, you could be growing a cut flower patch in pots outside your back door, or you've got 3 acres. It's, if you use your sweet peas to push everything round, then that... you can follow the sweet, everything follows the sweet peas. I mean, if you think about it, things like candy tuft and wallflowers are cabbages.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously not cabbages, but the cabbage family. So you can follow your sweet peas with your cabbages and then, and so on and so on. And that way, I mean, I'm not obsessive about it, but it does mean that I very rarely sow anything. I don't think I've ever sown anything in the same place 2 years running.
Okay.
And I'm lucky because I've got a bit of space, so actually I do a 4-year rotation because I have tulips, and the tulips always, we're quite warm and wet here, and so I always get tulip fire, and so I really don't want my tulips to go back where they were for a long time.
And do you lift those tulips and replant every year?
No, they get composted, and that's only, well, my phone's ringing, I'm sorry. But I'm not going to answer it. Sorry about that. Okay, if you're a cut flower grower and you're going to sell your produce, sweet tulip bulbs are very inexpensive. And especially if you're buying them, you know, 250
in bulk,
at a time. And so for the price, it would slow me down. So all the time I'm thinking about how much time everything takes, because time is money. So if I'm cutting a tulip by having to run my hand down the stem and leave the leaves,
yes,
so that they can absorb the goodness and settle in for the winter and summer and come back next year, it takes me longer. Whereas if I literally stick a fork under the square of tulips and loosen them all up, I then just pull them out one with the bulb, and I snap the bulb off, it goes straight to the compost. And then I can pull them at 50, you know, I pull them at 50s at a time.
And start again.
And start again. Plus also, I don't know about you, but the lovely thing about growing cut flower patches is, especially if you successionally have different looks through the season, it's like completely redesigning your garden 2 or 3 times a year. Or it's like, you know, having a new duvet cover in your bed. You completely change everything with not an enormous amount of work. And so the tulips I love this year and the tulips I love next year will probably be very different.
But, do you know, it's interesting where I look after Stocktonbury, people will come in and they'll say, oh, can't bear lupins. And we've grown loads of them because the year before everybody wanted lupins. And it's incredible how things change. 1 year you cannot sell something, the next year you can't get enough.
I know, and it's exactly the same about fashion. You know, my years as a fashionista, followed by my years as a gardener, especially because I'm growing bouquets that I sell to other people, they never look the same 1 year to the next, ever. And that's because, you know, you suddenly, I'll suddenly get an urge for, it's like the same as with clothes. You think, oh, you know, I really fancy a lilac sweater. And suddenly you'll find that everybody's wearing a lilac sweater and all the gardens will be lilac and mauve and purple.
And it's really weird.
And
it
is really, we are all really very affected by marketing.
Yeah.
We don't think we are, but we really are. And there will have been a point, even in a gardener's life, where you're planning sometimes 18 months in advance, where an urge for a purple, you know, you might have decided you're going to plant lilac instead of white lilac 2 years ago. And it'll be the right one. It'll be the one that everyone wants.
Well, let's hope so. Now, dahlias.
Yes.
Do you lift those in Somerset or not?
I didn't. For years and years and years, I didn't. I had a patch of a little over half an acre with 5 big beds, and they were full of dahlias. And I used to leave them in the ground and just lift one each of my favourites so that I could, and then I would propagate from that one so that in case it, you know, I lost them all. And last year I had just a tiny bit of virus, it was just a build-up of not looking as well. And so I lifted them all and threw away, and she was a great opportunity. I threw away probably 2/3 of them and just kept the ones I really loved, which are now split and putting up in the sprouting away in the tunnel, where they've been frost damaged. The leaves have got frost damage.
It's unbelievable this year. It is unbelievable.
But I mean, the other thing that I'm very aware of is, you know, I'm running around the garden with supports and thinking, oh, crikey, they're going to flop. You know, it's all really full on now in May. So for you, your supports, I would imagine, are fence posts and quite robust, aren't they?
What's interesting is we don't do that much support. Where we do support, it's fence posts. We'll have fence posts at either end of a long row and maybe one or two in the middle.
Yeah.
So for the sweet peas, for example, it's a fence post situation, and I'll have a 100-foot run of sweet peas. And we now have this lovely jute netting, which
was on your video.
Yes, but the problem with the jute netting is the string stretches, and so they sag. So you need more uprights, and they've got to be stronger uprights. And you actually need to run something along the top, sort of sew it through the netting to keep it strong.
Yeah.
And I don't think it would be strong enough for Cobia scandens. So I'm growing my Cobia scandens up because Cobia, you know how heavy it is. So I'm growing it up. It's rather over-engineered Heath Robinson thing that Fabrizio has made out of old bits of, what's that stuff that clematis grows up? You know, when you put it on a fence. Oh,
trellis.
Trellis, yes. So I've got two bits of trellising on fence posts, and my cobia's going to climb up because it's stronger.
But you see, sometimes I walk around the garden and I can see where I've put metal supports in round a peony, and sometimes the wind will get them and it almost beheads them. So I'm sort of in the middle thinking, actually, you could over-support.
I totally agree. And I did that storm we had last weekend, which was just ridiculous.
Mm.
I wouldn't normally be supporting my peony. I'm not a big peony grower, to be honest, and I've only just put a bed in last year, sort of to see.
Yeah.
They're a bit uncertain for me, for my what I do, because I don't sell single stems. I don't sell bunches of 10. They don't flower at a regular, you know, they'll flower at some point in a 6-week period, and that's not specific enough for me for the amount of space they use. But I did net them for last weekend because I nearly lost two, which would have been really boring because I haven't seen them flower yet, and I'm quite looking forward to them.
Yeah.
But for the netting, as a top tip for your listeners, if you're growing a cut flower patch, the idea is that you cut the flowers. And the reason we don't have much support, and I won't stake my dahlias, for example, is because the reason that dahlia plants are really heavy is because the flower heads are really heavy. And if they are filled on a normal day, they look fine, just bobbing around in the breeze. But if there's going to be a big storm in August or September, which often there is, the answer is to go out and cut your dahlias.
Before.
And cut them hard. And then they'll be fine. It's the heads that weigh. If you ever pick a dahlia head, you pick a cafe au lait head after a rainstorm, and it'll weigh it, you know, a pound full of water. Those lovely petals catch everything and hold it. They're like big cups. So no wonder those brittle stems snap very easily. The other top tip, if anybody is laying out a cut flower patch, is to work out where the prevailing wind is coming from. And say you are the prevailing wind, Tamsin.
I can do that.
Coming towards me, then I would have long, thin beds between me and the prevailing wind so that the wind can escape down paths between the beds.
Yeah.
And I only have that one set up in one of my patches. Can you imagine how disorganized? And in that patch, which is where I used to have my dahlias, I lost practically nothing. Even with those August storms, everything would be fine.
Brilliant.
The rest of my patch, the beds are done in the wrong direction. But never mind.
But you've put hedging in, obviously, because it's, you've, I think that's something that if you're going to do this, you've got to put filtering boundaries, haven't you, if you're doing this on a big scale. But the other thing I wanted to ask you about is watering. Now, at Stocktonbury, we're in Herefordshire, we get loads more rain than you. We never water anything in the ground, ever.
Wow.
Yeah. No, never.
That's so amazing.
I wanted to ask you, we haven't even got a hose pipe.
I'm astonished. What, even when you're planting out, you just...
I might use a watering can. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we do water. We, oddly enough, we don't water that much because we are southwest, so we're quite wet.
Okay.
And we're thick clay, so, you know, you don't have to go too far down to hit the water table. But when we're planting out, I will water like billio.
Yeah.
So, for example, this very dry April that we've just had.
Awful.
Not a shower to be seen.
No.
I did plant out, so the frosts were horrible, and I was like, oh, I'm just going to take my life in my hands and plant out. And I covered everything in tunnels of netting, which do make a little microclimate. So they were okay. It was like putting everything in a cold frame. But it was very, very dry. So I did water when I put them in. And I do have leaky pipes going along the top of above the ground. So the seedlings have gone in at, you know, ground level, and then 20 centimeters up, I have a leaky pipe which runs along the bed and will stay there until they're really well established. Having said that, we've now had some really fantastic rain, and I think we can take that all away there.
It's amazing how things have grown. It's quite, they were so dead. There's something magical about rainwater, isn't there?
It is really exciting.
It just, I mean, I know you don't want it when you can't sit in a restaurant at the moment, everybody, but we do.
We're really happy with this rain. And occasionally I see people going, I'm not complaining, but it's raining again. And I'm going, you don't complain yet. You're not allowed to complain yet. You can complain in July.
Exactly.
Now, you're well documented in saying that you garden organically, you don't use any pesticides. And I take it that you're in an environment, you've created an environment where you've got lots of wildlife coming in and there's sort of a cycle. Is that how it works for you?
That's exactly how it works. And for those, you know, as we all know, gardening is it's a long haul project. You can't instantly garden. And what we have discovered here, so we came here in 2004, and it was a big 7-acre green field. There was nothing here except for rye grass for feeding cattle. And that summer, I remember there would be blades of grass kind of as tall as me. Not as tall as me, as tall as my waist. I'm short, but I'm not short. But blades of grass are literally waist height. And they would have 5 or 6 slugs on them, just hanging off them. They were disgusting. And I thought, my God, this is the end of the world.
Yeah.
And we have gardened organically since then. So we've now gone from a 7-acre field of slugs and ryegrass to 35 different kinds of wildflower. And my husband's planted half a mile of hedging.
Wow.
And hedging is in the 7 acres. So you can imagine it's quite lots of little patches. And some of the hedging is really tall. It's mostly native hedging. So it's, you know, hawthorn and blackthorn and things. And the great thing about a tall hawthorn or blackthorn hedge is it's a brilliant, they're full of bats. There are bats everywhere. So the bats come in, and then you have compost heaps, and my husband won't let me turn the compost heaps and use the compost because there's always someone, as far as he's concerned, living there who mustn't be disturbed. And it is true that we now have grass snakes, slow worms, hedgehogs, toads. You know, if you make space for the wildlife, it comes in. And what's happened is, and it's been very, very noticeable over the last 2 or 3 years, I think what happens is and this is obviously not scientifically proven, this is just Georgie's theory.
Yeah.
But I think if you garden organically, even in a really tiny space, every 12 months, because that's a whole cycle, you will get 100% more wildlife. So if you start with only slugs, you will have a terrible, terrible time. But a year later, you will have something that will help eat the slugs. And a year after that, you'll have something that'll help eat the something that's eating the slugs, and so on, so on. And suddenly, one day, you have a barn owl and you've got the whole food chain enacting itself in front of you. And last year, it was amazing. I have to say, lockdown for people living in gardens and working in gardens, I think it was fortunate beyond all our possible imaginings. But to be able to stand out early in the morning, like 5:30 in the morning, and listen to the bird song here when it was lockdown, so there wasn't a car to be heard.
We've got the ACSB
very close by, so which is not exactly the M6, but it's a pretty noisy road. And you couldn't hear anything except for the bird song.
Bliss.
Amazing. And I've seen birds. I'm still seeing new birds. You know, we came and we had sort of the obvious garden birds. But now we have, I saw goldcrests the other day, which I hadn't seen here before. And sometimes I'll go up the field and there'll be two or three green woodpeckers working their way across the wildflower meadow. And then there's a greater spotted woodpecker. We put lots of rather, very expensive bird bat boxes up. I mean, they cost like 65 quid each. And the greater spotted woodpeckers come along and go, oh, just make a big hole in this one. You're really, do you know how much money we spent on that thing? I can't do
that. Brilliant.
But and if you can do that, I mean, I'm quite evangelical about it, but you know, if you can. So I remember planting out a row of cornflowers once, and I just lost a lot to slugs overnight. And it was really heartbreaking. And this was probably 10 or 11 years ago. And I don't think I would now lose. I mean, there is slug damage, but I don't lose whole crops to slugs anymore because there's someone to eat the slugs. Thank goodness for that.
Excellent. So it's a time issue. Now, just to end, I've got to ask you, which is the cut flower that you just could not cope without?
You horrible girl.
I know.
I stay with the dahlias. I wouldn't be without a dahlia.
Yeah.
And the reason I wouldn't be without a dahlia is not because, it's just because they are the single hardest working flower in your garden. If you think, you know, sweet peas are fabulous and they'll flower like mad for 6 weeks, but after that the stems are very short and they get botrytis and they're a bit tired and, you know, suddenly they become rather hard work. Roses are amazing. Really amazing. But again, you know, they'll start flowering at the end of May, end of July, kind of, you know, two whole months of really giving it some welly, but then they will take a break. Dahlias, they start flowering at the end of July and they do not take a break until the first frost. And they flower and flower and flower and flower and flower. I mean, they just don't stop. And they're light. I hate the winter. I really hate it. But I love the way when the light drops towards the end of the summer and gets under the petals of the dahlias and they change colour. Their colours become much more intense. Or you'll find a dahlia that looks quite a flat colour in July and you think, well, I don't plant this. By the end of October, just go out there and have a little cry.
It'll pop.
Oh, well, I mean, you're like a dahlia. You're so full of energy and colour and excitement, and you don't stop. So I think that's probably the right flower for you. So just to finish, if anyone wants to go on your online courses, your physical courses, buy a bouquet, where do they head?
They come to www.commonfarmflowers.com. And thank you, Tamsin. That's very kind. Right.
Well, it's wonderful to chat to you. And I know your book, The Flower Farmer's Year, is ever popular, so that's a good thing for people to treat themselves to. So thank you so much and good luck for this year, and I just know people are going to be uplifted when they open a box of your flowers.
Oh, thank you very much, Tamsin. It's been really fun. I love doing this.
Isn't Georgie just a joy? And if you take a look at her bouquets on her website, you'll see that her personality is put into these sumptuous bouquets. Why not treat yourself to one? I know I'm very tempted. So thank you for joining me, and until next time, enjoy your garden.